This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll learn about Downtown SLO's efforts to maintain a vital city center during the pandemic.
Over the last 3 weeks, the city has deployed more than 30 parklets for our downtown businesses to do outdoor dining, to do outdoor barbering.
And edible insects.
There are people surrounding the table, so excited to eat bugs. Kids that will run up and grab handfuls of crickets or mealworms and just popping them in their mouths.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, August 10th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Before the pandemic, county health officers mainly worked behind the scenes. Now they are center stage. Most people in San Luis Obispo County are now very familiar with Dr. Penny Borenstein, and it's the same for neighboring counties. In a one-on-one conversation, KAZU's Erica Mahoney interviewed Dr. Gail Newell, the health officer for Santa Cruz County. They discuss a variety of topics, from new evidence on the effectiveness of masks to how the pandemic has affected her daily life.
In Santa Cruz County, the person in charge is Dr. Gail Newell, the county's health officer.
I was first just curious about when you became health officer and how someone comes into that role.
I have been health officer for the County of Santa Cruz for just over a year now, although it seems much longer at this point. Before that, I was health officer in San Benito County. And before that, I was working in public health in Fresno County. But during all of this time, I've been a practicing obstetrician gynecologist. So I did that for 30 years, delivering over 10,000 babies in my career. But I've always had an interest in public health and have dabbled in it along the way. And so when I retired from clinical practice in 2012, I started getting involved part-time in public health and then was hooked.
And now 2020 pandemic, and for the first time, I think a lot of community members now know the name of their public health officer. How has this, you know, affected your day-to-day life?
It is unbelievably difficult, this whole pandemic, for health officers. I'm sure that many of your listeners know that health officers have been experiencing a tremendous amount of harassment and abuse, become the targets for people's fear and anger about the impacts this virus has had on their lives. So in some respects, I've had far more notoriety than I was ever ready for, and certainly much of it is unwelcome.
When this is all over and you look back, what's something you're going to be proud of?
I'm really proud that I joined the other Bay Area health officers in early March to put down a strong shelter in place. We were the first health officers in the nation to do so. And as a result, we've been able to contain the virus in our communities in a way that hasn't been true anywhere else in the country. And I'm proud that I was part of the group that did that. And I'm grateful for my colleagues who have decades of experience in public health who mentored me through that.
California is seeing this spike, and I would say up until about a month ago, Santa Cruz County was doing fairly well in terms of containing the spread. And then recently cases spiked. What do you think happened?
Well, we started to see a little uptick in cases after Mother's Day, and we were able to do case investigations, and we found four distinct family clusters, all in the Watsonville area, and we were able to contain those clusters and shut them down. But as we've had more and more, we are unable to do that kind of containment. So now we move into mitigation strategy to try to look at a population level and how to work with the public to help lessen the impact of the disease. But what we're seeing is still the same mode of transmission. that generally people are getting the disease from gatherings of friends and family outside of their household unit. So close contact, generally not wearing face coverings, spending a lot of time together within 6 feet, often indoors. Those are all the big risk factors for disease spread.
The 18 to 34 year old age group comes to mind when you're talking about these things. They do have most of the cases now. So from your perspective, you know, why do you think that's happening?
The 18 to 34 year age group is definitely the fastest growing age group, not only in the county of Santa Cruz, but throughout the state of California and across the nation. It's understandable that this age group is tired of being at home, tired of being with their parents if they're living there, like my kids are, and ready to get out and spend time with their friends. And of course, this is multi-household gathering, and that puts people at risk. This age group also tend to be our frontline workers. So stocking the grocery shelves, being out and about with the public in their day-to-day work.
Recently, Santa Cruz County was placed on the state's COVID-19 watch list because of the case rate. So the state wants that number to be 100 people per 100,000 people. And I think as of Wednesday, it's 123. How do you see that number coming down?
It's going to be individual behaviors that make a difference in that case rate. And I think that the new economic restrictions that we're under now that we've exceeded that case rate will remind people of the importance of limiting their gatherings with others, of wearing their face coverings, of staying 6 feet apart, the importance of all of those. Until we're all doing those more consistently, we're going to be under these economic restrictions, and our schools aren't going to be able to open either. So it's really those behaviors that impact our ability to return to some sense of normalcy.
That's something you've said before, that it's individual behaviors that are perpetuating the spread of the coronavirus. So what do you think needs to change?
I think that when the governor reopened the economy in May, that it happened too quickly. One opening after another without really seeing the impact of each opening. And I think it sent a message to the people of California that it was party time, that things were going to go back to normal. It didn't help that it was the beginning of summer. It was the time of year when we celebrate graduations, Mother's Day, Father's Day, Memorial Day, and then 4th of July. And all of those events and the sense of returning to normal and the sun's out and it's summertime, it really made people feel like they could go back to how things used to be, and we're not there yet.
So originally you had closed the beaches and there were these restrictions in place where you couldn't come to the beach. And then I think it was around 4th of July that those restrictions were lifted. You know, from your point of view, do you think that led to any increase in cases?
Well, I want to make sure that our listeners understand that beaches themselves are not dangerous for COVID-19. We know more about this virus now, and we know that being outdoors, especially if you're active outdoors, it's almost impossible for disease transmission to occur in that setting. So the reason the beaches were closed were never about preventing disease at the beach. It was about discouraging travelers from coming into our community. And I think in that regard, the beach partial closure from 11 in the morning to 5 every day was effective. But it just didn't make sense anymore after the governor started promoting tourism throughout California and allowing non-essential travel and booking of our hotels and short-term vacation rentals. It's something that we could consider again locally, but it may not be that effective in light of the governor's promotion of tourism.
What worries you the most at this point?
The things that I lose sleep over at night. I worry about our most vulnerable populations, as we've seen in other communities across our nation. The populations who are most at risk are the people who are in the skilled nursing facilities or nursing homes and places like our jails. And so in those kind of congregate living settings, as we call them, there's not a lot of choice for those folks about who they're exposed to or how. And when an outbreak happens, it can spread very quickly, as we've seen at San Quentin Prison. That's where I'm most worried and where we're focusing most of our effort in public health.
That kind of all ties back to housing being in close quarters. We've also seen nationwide the pandemic disproportionately affect communities of color. And I know in Santa Cruz County, slightly over 50% of the cases are among Hispanics and Latinos. How is the county working to address that?
Yeah, so this is a trend we saw very early, beginning after Mother's Day. And since then, the vast majority of our COVID-19 cases have been in South County. So we've been working with a group out of Pajaro Valley, the PVPSA and associates, to message culturally appropriately and bilingually, plus some Mixteco, to message to our populations there who are especially vulnerable. And it's not because Latinx people are more genetically predisposed to get this virus or anything like that. It has to do with what we call the social determinants of health. So housing, many of these families live in crowded housing where it's difficult to isolate or quarantine if there's impacted family members. Many of them work on the front lines of essential work, like our agriculture workers, our skilled nursing facility, healthcare workers come from this area usually. So they've got riskier work to do.
In the beginning of the pandemic, the messaging around masks was that they protected others. And now that's changing, right?
Right. So there's increasing evidence that when you wear a mask or a face covering of any kind, that you are not only protecting those around you, but maybe yourself as well. And some recent evidence I've heard from UC San Francisco supports a theory that perhaps by wearing a face covering, you're getting less of an inoculum, so fewer strands of the virus that enter into your mouth and nose via droplets, and that results in, we think, a more mild case of COVID-19 and less likely to end up needing to be hospitalized and less likely to die.
Looking back, what have you learned since the pandemic first began in Santa Cruz County?
Well, we know a lot more about the virus than we did back in January when we first started working on this. So, you know, some people have felt like that was a wasted 6 months of sheltering in place and restricting ourselves and our economy, but it was actually a very important time for us to prepare and learn more about this virus. And we have learned a lot more about the virus. We have more effective treatments in the hospital. We have a better understanding of how the virus spreads and doesn't spread. And face coverings, as we talked about, are a great example of that.
Is there any end in sight for this pandemic?
Well, I know that we're all hanging our hopes on vaccine. And I wouldn't hold my breath for that to happen in early 2021. I think we're looking beyond that, late 2021 or 2022, to the point where we have any significant herd immunity in our population, either by vaccination or by illness. We're in it for the long haul here, so everybody should buckle up and get ready for a bumpy ride ahead.
That was Dr. Gail Newell, the health officer for Santa Cruz County.
That was KAZU's Erica Mahoney. Working Lunch is a weekly Facebook Live conversation between the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and someone in the community doing interesting or innovative work. Today, we'll hear from Downtown SLO's Bettina Swigger.
Hello, and welcome to Working Lunch, the SLO Chamber's weekly series where we get to sit down with our community leaders and bring back some of that connection we've all been missing during these COVID days of social distancing. Today, we'll get some inside perspective from the Downtown SLO CEO, Bettina Swigger. She has served as the CEO of Downtown SLO since October 2018. She moved to San Luis Obispo from Colorado in 2011 to run a little organization you might be familiar with, Festival Mosaic, where she served for 8 years. Bettina, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, Jim. Thanks so much for the opportunity to join you on this working lunch.
How did you come to this role and kind of what drew you to it?
I was actually thinking about the foundation that I had as a young person growing up in my community in Albuquerque. I lived very close to an urban center. I lived near the university. There's a University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. And I was walking distance from Central Avenue, which is one of the main roads that goes through there. It's kind of a cool place to hang out too. So when I was in high school, I played in a youth symphony and I hung out kind of in the university district. Later on, I went to college and I was in Colorado College, which is a liberal arts school in Colorado Springs. And it's just adjacent to the downtown in that area. I took a gap year. And before I moved to Colorado Springs, I lived in Durango, Colorado for a year. And I worked at a coffee shop in the downtown. And so I got to experience what that was like doing customer service. While I was in college, I worked a lot of different jobs, a lot of restaurant customer service positions. So while my formal adult career has been mostly in nonprofit administration, I really see myself as somebody who just is excited to meet people where they are in the community. And where that happens to be frequently is downtowns and where there's activity and where people come together. So I have a passion for placemaking and bringing people together. And I always like to tell my team that we try to surprise and delight people. And I believe that the arts surprise and delight people frequently, but our places also do. So when I came to San Luis Obispo, I remember this very distinctly, actually. The first moment I set foot in this town was Halloween 2010, and I flew in for a job interview. First of all, it was when the airport was really small, and the director of the search committee picked me up, and there were like five people that he knew in the airport lobby. So that was a pretty clear indication that this was a special place where you kind of didn't have the opportunity to meet a stranger, if you know what I mean. But it was Halloween and I stayed at the Garden Street Inn that night. And I went on a walk. We went out and had dinner, at Coberl at Blue. It was the first place I had, a meal in San Luis Obispo in the downtown. I stayed at the Garden Street Inn and I walked around the community and I looked at all of the public utility boxes that were painted. And that's a great program that the city's public art program runs. And I just thought, gosh, this is a place that cares about good food, about being together, and about public art. And that was really what made me fall in love with this place was the downtown. And of course, the fantastic organization that was Festival Mosaic that I ended up running for 8 years. But ultimately, what brought me to downtown SLO was I came here every day when the opportunity came up. I was excited about getting a little bit more involved in the direct economic vitality part of the community.
Many people know about the Downtown SLO organization as the catalyst for those signature events like our farmers market and the concerts in the plaza. Obviously, those aren't happening right now.
Right before everything happened, sort of in March, we were actually headed into a strategic planning process. We had just done a gigantic community survey where we'd had thousands of people chime in and tell us what they thought was important about the downtown. And one of the things that we were planning to do prior to COVID was streamline some of the work that we did and really try to deepen the relationship that we have with our stakeholders. And our primary stakeholders are the businesses who make up our membership. The way that our organization is structured is we have a contract with the city. And when you get a business license with the city that's in a particular set of boundaries in the downtown, you pay an additional business license fee. And that comes to our organization and allows us to do our work promoting downtown as an economically vibrant place. We support our businesses and we provide additional economic support that's beyond what you might get if you were in another geographic area of the city. So that prior to COVID made up about a third of our income. And then we produced and planned events that were designed to bring people to the downtown so that those businesses would then be successful. Well, without the events, we're still doing the work about marketing and communication. That has actually been the primary focus of what we've been doing over the last 4 months is having regular conversations with our membership. We have Monday morning calls at 10 a.m. in a Zoom room just like this. And we have people from the city, from the county, from the chamber, from Cal Poly. We all come together and kind of talk about where we are in the particular situation and in the moment as it changes week to week.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between the SLO Chamber's Jim D'Antona and Downtown SLO's Bettina Swigger.
So our primary activity has shifted from bringing events to make people come downtown and be excited about downtown to responding to COVID-19 and trying to decode the rapidly changing information and get the opportunities out to our businesses.
That has been something you've always done. Do you think any of these will be kind of permanent changes in terms of balancing what people see and what you're doing? Or as soon as the farmer's market comes back in concerts, that's still going to be the biggest draw?
You know, it's so hard to say. I think I'm just kind of questioning my relationship with the word permanent in general these days. It's turned me into more of like a Zen Buddhist practitioner, because really all we have is this moment. And a joke that I've made frequently on the Monday morning Zoom calls is that all we have are 3 days. We have today, we have tomorrow, and we have yesterday. So that's kind of the moment that I'm living in right now. But I do think that there are some successes that have come out of this time. I think our relationship with our individual business stakeholders has strengthened. But yes, there's great value in having an organization that can speak with one voice for a diverse group of people and a diverse group of businesses. So, you know, the Chamber is a strong voice in our region, obviously. And then Downtown SLO is also sort of a microcosm of that type of unifying voice. And part of the work that I do is with International Downtown Association. And so I have weekly calls with other CEOs of other downtown management and place management organizations in large cities, small cities, all across the country. And not every city has been so adaptive to this unique challenge that we're, nor this not unique challenge we're facing. And, you know, over the last 3 weeks, the city has deployed more than 30 parklets in our downtown for our downtown businesses to do outdoor dining, to do outdoor barbering. But responsiveness of the city to respond to immediate needs and to put programs like Open Slow and be iterative and change it so that it can be better serving the business's needs as they change along with the emergency has really been remarkable.
I think feel like we're pretty lucky to have a city that is really trying to respond to this issue. There are no great answers. And so we all have seen what you're talking about, those parklets. Downtown's looking a lot different these days. Looking at it from Downtown SLO, how have you been assisting your members with reopening? I know you've had several projects.
Yeah, I mean, this changes every day, it feels like. I'm sure that you can relate to that. In the early stages of the emergency, a lot of it was just reaching out and making sure that people felt supported, right? So we called every single one of the phone numbers that we had for our downtown businesses and said, how are you? What do you need? And at the beginning, we didn't know how quickly the disease would spread. We didn't know if there'd be federal relief. There were lots of things that we didn't know. Today, I think that our response is more about decoding information, definitely. I mean, that's a big part of it, right? So we try to make sure that we're as informed as possible, because we know that other people who are out there running their businesses day to day don't have the bandwidth or the time or even the space in their schedule to watch the governor's daily updates and read all of the reports that are coming out and make sure that they understand what's happening in city council. So we are kind of a distillery. Well, I don't know if that's the right word. Maybe an aggregator would be a better word for information, and kind of like a decoder ring. But we've also tried to help our businesses in really practical ways. So one way we did this was when we were going through the reopening, we offered these kits for free to our businesses called the We Got This Kit. And the message behind that was, we got this. And also, we got this kit. So it was play, but also had practical items that people would need to reopen their businesses. So that included a few masks, lots of gloves, paper towels, which for a while were kind of hard to buy, right? And then we partnered with a hand sanitizer distillery, which is why that word was in my brain, and in Paso. And they gave us a great deal on, gosh, a couple thousand dollars worth of hand sanitizer that we now have in our office, and we can give to anybody if they need that equipment for, you know, opening up a retail shop or their architecture firm, whatever they might need.
People weren't sure where they were going to find their PPE. I know you're in extraordinarily close contact with so many of your members, social distance contact, but in those connections, like you talked about your Monday meetings and your kind of walk arounds and talks with folks, how are people feeling this week?
So this morning I was walking around and looking at all of the parklets, and it really is remarkable to see how the downtown environment has changed. My thinking as we move into this current phase of the emergency is that we really need to focus our work in three facets. The first is the environment. So what does the environment look like, and how can we make it safe for business and commerce to happen safely? So that's like the parklets, all of these other activities that are going on. The second is innovation. So how are the businesses having space to innovate and adapt their businesses? So in the early stages of the shutdown, we saw restaurants turn into de facto grocery stores, right? That was super cool to see. And then the third is the economy. So what kinds of policies are coming out of the federal, the state, the county, and the city that will offer direct support to the businesses so they can continue to employ people, continue to conduct businesses and bring in sales tax and all of the different revenues that are needed to keep a society functioning, essentially. Today, there is, I believe, some concern about the unemployment money running out. I have heard from some downtown businesses that they've been unable to recruit as many of their former employees back because that unemployment money was high. That's going to be changing. I've also heard from others that they are not going to be able to keep their staffing at the levels that it's been because the business activity just hasn't been what they expected. And that is understandable, right? Because we are in a public health crisis and a lot of people don't feel comfortable going out, even if they are staying 6 feet apart and if they are wearing a mask. Maybe they're in a vulnerable population, or they live with somebody who's vulnerable, or they just don't want to run the risk. So everything's kind of up in the air. But with these new parklets downtown, there is a general sense downtown, I believe, of optimism, resilience. So I hope that that continues.
And as you're talking about, you know, there have been so many changes in all of our lives and the organizations because of COVID. Are there any changes kind of personally or professionally that you think or hope may be permanent?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I will say that for our organization, I mentioned that, you know, our revenue came from events, and that has led to some permanent layoffs for our staff. And that's been really personally heartbreaking. I had to let people go that I cared deeply about and really enjoyed working with and who served our community very, very well. So I want to honor them and just say how hard that was to say goodbye. And also to all of you out there who have had to make those difficult decisions. That's a real thing. And there are mental health challenges that come with that. On the positive side, I think that we are going to see that the businesses that are accustomed to being creative and willing to adapt are going to see the most success and come out of this the strongest. From a space perspective, not outer space, but just physical space in the downtown, I think that our downtown is actually positioned in a place to be a little bit better off than some of the other communities that I work with. For the simple reason that we don't have sprawling skyscrapers full of office workers, and we don't have this sort of looming sense of the office workers never coming back. The biggest employers in our downtown area are actually the county and the city government. So we've definitely seen a fall off in some foot traffic during the week and in that lunchtime crowd from people who might still be working from home, who work for the city and the county. But there's nothing like what I'm seeing and hearing from my colleagues in other cities about how they are just looking at like total revisioning of what the daytime week commerce looks like in the downtown cores as our relationship to where we work, working remote, and all of that changes.
I understand you're working on your first book.
What
spurred you to take on something like that? And what's that process been like?
It is important for us to have activities outside of our jobs. And my book project is definitely something that's outside of my job. So I've been a writer for my whole life. I have a degree in literature. Once upon a time, I was a freelance writer for various independent news weeklies. And been working on a book for the last 4 years, really in earnest. It's a project about what happened to me when I lost my mother very suddenly when I was 29 years old. And I had a pretty crazy year, the year that I turned 30. I moved across the country. I lost my mother. I got divorced. My grandmother died. And I had some other issues that were just It was the year that everything kind of went upside down. It's been really interesting because I've been working on this book for such a long time. I have about 80% of a manuscript done right now, although I don't know if I'll ever finish it. If my goal is perfection, which you shouldn't strive for perfection, you should just strive for better. But I would like to finish that. And it's been interesting to look back on some of the chapters that were causing me trouble and puzzling me over the past, before COVID, and to look back and see how dark I thought things were at that time, but how I came out of it with this really bright, shining space for joy that I didn't know that I had before. And how even in these troublesome times and worrisome times, I am better because I went through all of that darkness. And I think that there may be a lesson there, right? So we're going through a dark time as a world and we don't know what's going to happen, but we have to learn some lessons and we can emerge from these crises with our hearts intact, with our brains more willing to learn and take on new challenges and have a deeper appreciation for what it means to be alive and together.
Thanks so much, Bettina. Please stay healthy out there.
That was Working Lunch with the San Luis Obispo Chamber's Jim D'Antona and Downtown SLO's Bettina Swigger. The Point San Luis Lighthouse just celebrated its 130th birthday. While it's closed for actual tours during the pandemic, its history is rich, and there are lots of plans for the future. For this edition of the Nonprofit Story, Consuelo Mukes sits down with Deborah Fauti of the Lighthouse Keepers.
So welcome to the Nonprofit Story. I'm Dr. Consuelo Mukes. Joining me today on the program is Deborah Fauti, Executive Director of the nonprofit organization Point San Luis Lighthouse Keepers. And Deb, welcome to the show.
Very happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you because you're a nonprofit in San Luis Obispo County. So Deb, tell us about the Lighthouse.
Well, you know, Consuelo, since I've been out there for about 10 years, the most common thing I hear from paddlers that can come in by water, whether they use their paddle boards or their kayaks, once we get the hikes up again after the COVID is over, the hikers, and then our tour programs, there are so many people that have lived here that say, we didn't know this was here.
I'll bet.
So we're kind of the best kept secret, you know, isn't that funny? And yet we are still considered an operating lighthouse because of the flash, the light. We still have, if you are in Pismo or Five Cities, you can still see our light at night. Mm-hmm. It still has a signature. So it's like a 1 second flash and a 3 second interval. So that would all be listed with the Coast Guard for mariners. So we're still considered a working lighthouse.
Tell us where you're located.
Well, they can't see us. That's one thing because we are around the breakwaters out at Port San Luis. So you would go out to Avila Beach and continue down Avila Beach Drive. And the way we access the property, not by water, is mm-hmm. by going through the security gate at Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. Well, since that is a nuclear power plant, it's very secure. So we have only permitted driving with employees, volunteers. Everyone else accesses with our shuttle service when we are up and running. Of course, right now we can't, since we are considered an indoor museum, such as the Getty and Hearst Castle. Other ways of accessing the property is to hike in, and the same thing goes for them. They will be in operation again when we can. So that is the way the general public can access us. I get phone calls all the time with people saying, well, can't we just drive up there? We can't. It's a very narrow, steep, curvy road.
I had an opportunity to visit you, and it is absolutely stunningly beautiful. So when people do get up there, I think they're really surprised at the view and all of that property that you have. So tell us a little bit now about the importance of this historic location.
So if you think about our location, we are nearly halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco. So there was a real need to have a lighthouse there in the later 1800s. Our port became very, very busy. We were very agriculturally strong. There were so many things like livestock and grains and all these things that could be imported, and of course, a lot of them were going north. They didn't take land because we are encompassed by mountains. The freeway basically was the ocean. So it was very important to have the ships being able to go in and out for not only bringing people, but exporting their goods and importing lumber. So as they were coming down from the north, they were bringing the redwood. And that's what was contributing to the growth of Little Avila. So not only the exporting, but the importing. And then soon after that, we became a huge exporter of the oil that was coming in from Santa Maria Valley, and then later our Central Valley, because we were an operating lighthouse and the port was an international port by that time. They piped it in from the Central Valley. So therefore, Tank Farm Road, a lot of tanks were there to hold that oil.
Right.
And if you take a look out in Avila, you'll see where tanks would have been located to hold the oil before it was shipped out. So what is now the Cal Poly Pier was Unocal in the day, and that's where the ships would come in and get the oil and head on out of there. So with the importance of the traffic, the amount of traffic that was going in and out of Avila, there was a huge need for lighthouses. When you have a series of lighthouses up and down the coast, you can safely transport people and their goods, and therefore you have commerce. And that's how communities start to grow.
And when you say in the day, when was this?
You know, West Coast lighthouses are not nearly as old as East Coast lighthouses.
Mm-hmm.
But interesting enough, 1890 is when the lighthouse was finished. And in fact, August 8th was our birthday. So we became 130 years old.
Congratulations. Well, this is a big year for you. But too bad we're in the COVID-19. I guess you would have been having a lot of celebrations for this.
Yes. Like everyone else, we'll be moving many of our plans to 2021.
So you became the lighthouse, 1890, bringing the ships in. And now you are a historical location. Are there a lot of lighthouses the same?
Well, three lighthouses of the same architecture were built about the same time in California. There was one to the north in Humboldt area and another one in the San Diego area. When the Coast Guard took over the responsibilities of running lighthouses, sometime after that, they were looking for automation. Of course, technology was being developed. And when you no longer needed staff to manage the horns or the lights, the lenses, then it all became automated. A lot of those places were closed up. A lot of lighthouses have been taken over by the state. We have some communities that have purchased lighthouses and turned them into historical societies. We have some that have become bed and breakfasts. The ones that were the sisters to this lighthouse are no longer there. We are standing probably because of our location.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because people can't get there, or the property couldn't be sold because of our proximity to the nuclear power plant, it basically stood vacated for about 25 years.
Oh.
Yeah.
Then it came back. And then when did the lighthouse keepers begin to come around, and what do the lighthouse keepers do?
The keepers formed a nonprofit to do the restoration of this property. Like I said, it had been standing vacant for about 25 years, and it was certainly showing the wear and tear of not being taken care of. Luckily, the headkeeper's residence and the tower and the horn house are built with old growth redwood. So that stands well, and it's something termites don't like. The structure itself is built well, so it was basically a lot of paint to scrape and some other kinds of things that had to be done. But they started the whole process in about 1993. 95 is when the keepers were incorporated as a nonprofit. The Harbor District holds the deed to this property, so we are very unique with how we began this adventure. Restoration, maintenance, all went until about 2010, and we were finally able to begin tours and start the tour program and shuttle people up in trolleys in those days. And we've since had to move into shuttles.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Consuelo Mukes is talking with Deborah Fauti of the Point San Luis Lighthouse Keepers.
So there was a time, until recently, when people could come up.
So a couple of times a week, Wednesdays and Saturdays, we did our public tours and the public hikes. And then we also have done weddings. We've done some corporate meetings up there. We're set up in an event center. It was a remodeled barracks, basically, for Coast Guard in the day. We have a semi-commercial kitchen, so we're able to bring caterers in. But yeah, we've had a lot of celebrations. We have an absolutely beautiful event place right hanging off the coast, right on the cliff, I should say, that has been beautifully landscaped. We've had volunteers that have still been able to come out to pull weeds. Absolutely gorgeous. It's just that no one can see it right now.
No, you have a beautiful swing out there.
The swing is very well known. Uh-huh. And a lot of paddlers basically make their way up there to get on the swing. And the next attraction, once you're done swinging, have been the new dedication benches that we are putting in. Nice. So that's a new program for us, and people can purchase a dedication bench for a loved one that maybe they want to memorialize or maybe they want to recognize. Really fun to sit in these beautiful cast concrete benches and just gaze out at the sea. So first you swing and then you run over to the bench.
That sounds relaxing too. And so many of us could use that. I'm wondering now, how do you actually stay alive? I mean, who supports you? Because you are a nonprofit organization.
Well, when we are not in the pandemic, of course, all of the money that we receive as tour fees or any kind of the special events, that is the funding that we use to continue our operation. Maintenance. We're still doing a bit of restoration. All of the upkeep. Saturday, we streamed a virtual concert since we can't be out there this year, and we featured Carbon City Lights. We also have some videos that are available to be seen on our website if you missed the streaming on Saturday, and it's wonderful to see. So that is being put on the website, I think, as we speak. Great. I wanted to keep it as a surprise for the birthday, and then it'll be up for sharing. We're able to offer what we called sponsored free days by the Port San Luis Harbor District. And we've been able to bring people up that maybe wouldn't have an opportunity to see the lighthouse, do an interpretive tour. We have invited CASA. We've had a couple of different seniors groups. We've had a lot of veterans. The list goes on and on. So we like to extend that invitation to groups, like I said, that maybe wouldn't be able to make it out to see us, whether it be income, handicap, age, whatever. In the last few years, we have met a lot of needs for handicapped people. We are ramped wherever we can ramp, and we have put together an interpretive tour for hard of hearing or deaf people. And we are going to be working next on a tour for the blind.
Wonderful, Deb.
Yeah. I do get questions sometimes. People will call in and say, well, how many steps are there? They remember, you know, you're built up on a hill and it's Victorian and bedrooms were always upstairs. You know, this does have a cellar, wow, which is not very common in California anymore. But we know that we can't get everyone that has mobility issues into those parts, but we can get them into a lot of other rooms. So they can enjoy tours with their families. Just this last December, we invited a lot of the senior care facilities out, and many, many, many wheelchairs were brought out. And it was just exciting to see this lineup, like a brigade of wheelchairs going down our boardwalk so they could access the head keeper's residence. And then later on, be able to come on into the fog signal room. And it was exciting because many of them had stories they wanted to share, because they had somebody in their family from that time. They could think about their grandfather or grandmother, and it was wonderful, and we want to do that again. The Harbor District assists with that sponsorship. We haven't been able to do it this year, unfortunately, so hopefully we'll get back to them next year when we get open.
Well, it's good to know that the Harbor District is helping you, and we don't often hear about all of the good things they're doing.
the Harold J. Miosi Foundation has been extremely helpful in our education component of our mission statement. And we have built a fourth grade curriculum. Well, when we could go into the classroom, introduce activities and books and such for the kids. And then after the curriculum is completed by the classroom, they are invited out to the light station for a field trip day with a lot of hands-on things. You know, our docents are also dressed in period attire. That's been another grant that we've received. When they're all dressed, and they dress like this, not only for the fourth graders, but they also dress like this when we do weddings and other events. So that's kind of the bonus of coming out and having your event there too, is to tour the lighthouse and fog signal building with these docents telling you the lighthouse story, all dressed in period attire.
And I surely hope that you're going to be able to get back to doing that soon. Although right now we're stuck with the COVID-19 and can't do it.
Now that we've got our virtual concert done, is the virtual actual tours of the light station. Through Zoom, volunteers put together an extremely wonderful virtual tour, but we will be live so that if you sign up to take this tour, it is interpretive. So that's going to be up and running, and you'll find that information on our website, which is pointsanluislighthouse.org.
So there you have it. You have the website. Thank you again, Deb Fauti of the Point San Luis Lighthouse. This has been Consuelo Mutes, The Nonprofit Story.
In many parts of the world, insects are included in everyday diets, but not in the United States. Not yet, anyway. Contributor Beth Thornton talks with UCSB scholar Mackenzie Wade about raising awareness and changing perceptions around this nutritious, sustainable food source.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with Mackenzie Wade from UC Santa Barbara. She's a PhD student studying insects as food. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Beth.
Mackenzie, tell us how you became interested in insects as food.
So it started in undergrad, and I went to school at Kansas State University. I'm originally from California, but I ended up in Kansas State, which is a really big ag school. A lot of people there eat meat, but I was in an environmental anthropology class, and we were really researching the impact of the livestock industry. And when you start to research that topic, I think a lot of us get a little bit unhappy about the food options that we have and the food choices that we make. But I didn't want to just cut something out of my diet. I wanted to think a little bit more creatively and think about different potentials for escaping that environmental impact while still having fun with the food that we eat, which led me to thinking about edible insects. And at this time, the FAO released a report called, I think, Edible Insects, Food and Feed Security. And they really urged Western countries to start considering insects as food. And I loved this idea, so I ended up cooking some insects in my college dorm room and in the communal kitchen, and sharing them with my friends and exploring the potential for edible insects in my diet and then in others' diets as well.
And were your friends receptive to this idea?
At first, I was the weirdo in the college dorm room. Honestly, the first time that I bought insects, I went to Petco, which is kind of hilarious, but, you know, where are you going to get bugs that you can cook up? So at Petco, I'm standing in line, and I get up to the counter, and the guy asks me, like, oh, do you have a lizard? I'm like, oh, yes, I have a lizard, just outright lying because I didn't want to tell him that I was going to be eating them. And today, that's, like, shocking because I'm sure those insects are very poor quality. But once I started sharing with people, you know, it's a really fun topic. It's really exciting to try something new, especially when it's prepared well. And so a lot of people were really interested in trying them. And I think I made a lot of friends through edible insects.
That led to your current research, which is looking at insects as food and the cultural aversions to eating them. So give us a brief description of the research you're working on now as a PhD student.
I am an anthropologist, and originally edible insects was simply just a side hobby. So I was looking at the relationship between people, culture, and food. And edible insects was just something that I would do on the side and talk about with people on the side. But I started to get involved in a lot of educational programs and groups, and I sort of hit the streets and talked to people at fairs and events about edible insects and shared them with people. And I realized that this is something really, really interesting, this aversion that we have to insects. And it's unique to many Western cultures or Western groups. And this aversion doesn't exist cross-culturally. So you see lots of insect eating in Southeast Asia, Thailand and Cambodia, for example, parts of Mexico like Oaxaca. We've also been eating insects since early human evolution. So insects are an important part of our diet, but we think of them now just as this food of the future. So something way in the future that we may be eating. Maybe it's like this dystopian future, but we really should be thinking about insects as a food of the past and a food of the present as well. So right now, my research is really looking at the U.S. edible insect industry, which a lot of people don't realize that there is a U.S. edible insect industry. You can actually find insects on our grocery store shelves. If you're in Santa Barbara, you can go to Ralph's, for example, and find cricket chips. So they're starting to enter the market. And what I'm looking at now is those groups, businesses, educational groups, how they're approaching the public with this food that we've been taught our entire lives is something that's disgusting or gross.
You've analyzed the business and environmental aspects of insect farming. Is that right? Is insect farming something that will happen on a mass scale?
That's kind of the goal. So insects overall have really been seen as this catch-all solution to a lot of problems in the food system. So for example, if we compare them to the livestock industry, insects, they contain a lot of protein, a lot of B12, a lot of things that are very good for us. Especially if you're a vegetarian for environmental reasons, they present great health options for you. And they take very minimal resources compared to livestock. So very little water, they produce minimal greenhouse gas emissions, they can be reared in urban spaces on organic material. So for example, we could be feeding them compost or food waste and turning that directly into protein. So on the sustainability side, they're a great option. What I was looking at when I was researching the industry was how they're taking these solutions that they are saying, okay, edible insects are great for sustainability and health and food security, food justice, all these sort of buzzwords that we use when we think about the problems in the food system. And they're saying edible insects are a great solution and we need to start industrializing them. And what I looked at was sort of if they were actually enacting their goals or their professed goals. And what we saw was that it seems like there is a little bit of a disconnect between the actual industrialization of insects and the sustainability goals that they're looking at. There aren't huge industrial facilities in the U.S. yet. The largest one is in Austin, Texas. It's pretty big. It's about 2 football fields long. So they're really the first in the U.S. to be experimenting with industrialization on such a large scale. But it's really a big question whether or not edible insects will be able to maintain this goal of sustainability when they start to be even more industrialized.
This is a conversation with Mackenzie Wade about edible insects. I did see that you can buy edible insects online. Are you starting to see that people are coming around?
Yes, definitely. And a lot of that is marketing, because this is probably one of the most difficult marketing hurdles ever to be faced. Because you're really taking something that people have considered as a disease carrier, disgusting, gross, something that you are trying to eliminate from your food. And these groups are then trying to show you actually these are food and they are good for us and they are good for the environment. So marketing has been really well done in the edible insect industry. If you just take a look at some websites like Chirp Chips or Exo Cricket Bars, these are like high protein bars, you can see that they're really showing you that this is a great food and it's a possible food source for us moving forward.
You've kind of zeroed in on kids because kids might be more willing, I think, to try eating an insect. Tell us about that kind of outreach.
We've been working with a woman named Allie Moore. She runs Buggable, based out of Los Angeles. And she and I have sort of created these amazing educational events and programs for kids. One, for example, is the Cooking with Critters program. That's mainly for Girl Scouts, but is also accessible for museums or schools. So the Girl Scout programs are amazing because usually we're told growing up that girls don't like bugs, right? And so you think talking to this group of 50 9-year-old girls that they're going to be a little bit averse to eating bugs, but actually the complete opposite is true. And this is true that I've found every time I do an event. There are people surrounding the table so excited to eat bugs. There will be kids that will run up and grab full handfuls of crickets or mealworms and just be running around feeding them to their friends or popping them in their mouths. And it's really exciting to see because kids, you know, they like to be adventurous, maybe not so much when it comes to food, but if you can make the insect food accessible, like bake mealworm cookies or chips, the kids are going to sort of be introduced to the idea that insects are potentially food, and they're going to have a lot of fun with it, and that's really what we've seen.
What are the most popular insects to eat, the best tasting?
Well, the most popular and the best tasting are actually two different answers. So the most popular definitely are crickets and mealworms because they're easiest to grow. So all of the farms really in the U.S., I think most of them, are growing crickets and mealworms. But those are not the tastiest. They are usually just baked and they're a little bit crispy. They don't have that much flavor, which is good when you're just starting to get into edible insects. But there are some insects that taste like charred bacon. There's three different flavor profiles that you can fit insects into. So the first category is earthy and nutty. And those are insects like crickets. They have just sort of a nutty taste to them, like a sunflower seed. The second category is the seafood-like category. So insects like scorpions, I know they're not technically insects, but they get grouped in here. They taste a lot like lobster or crab. They have that seafoody taste. And then the third category is meaty. So those are like mopani worms or any sort of large grub is going to taste really meaty. And those are actually my favorite.
They're usually cooked, right? You don't just pick them up out of the garden and pop them in your mouth.
No. You can wild catch insects, but usually the experts say that you should have them set aside for a while just to make sure that they haven't been ingesting any pesticides. But usually, yes, you would want to cook them. And to cook them, you can either bake them and create like a crispy snack to throw over salads, or to spice and just eat throughout the day. You can also saute them. So I love to saute my insects with onions and garlic. They take on a lot of flavor. Another interesting thing is that when you're growing insects, they often take on the flavor of what you feed them. So some people have shown that if you feed mealworms mint, for example, they'll have a little bit of a minty taste.
That was Mackenzie Wade, PhD student at UCSB. This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments, kcbx.org.